Donc, je vais parler en anglais, par respect à notre intervenant, Manuel, qui va aussi lui présenter en anglais. Si à la fin, vous avez des questions et que vous préférez de les poser en français, il n'y a aucun problème. Je vais faire mon mieux pour les traduire en anglais pour Manuel et traduire les réponses si besoin. So I'm very happy to present you, to introduce you my colleague and friend Manuel Beltran, a Spanish born but living in The Hague. He is a multifaceted artist, activist and researcher, and in his work he's been engaged with artificial intelligence and other forms of technologies that we in this group de travail, working group, research group are also engaged with. And we are going to focus on how the art can actually wake us up a bit, refresh and bring in true interdisciplinarity in the work of our research center. And I won't spend any more time and let Manuel speak. We will have a 20-minute intervention and then we will have your questions, I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me like this? Yeah, okay. Thank you all for coming after the lunch, and thanks a lot to Francesca and Melanie for organizing all of this and for the invitation. It's not very common for me as an artist to be invited to these setups. Normally, I tend to invite myself, people from these setups, to come to our events. We were discussing in the preparations how to bring a point on the value of the arts as part of an interdisciplinary form of research. So there are many cases in which I'm invited to groups of research at the later stage to make the PowerPoint presentations beautiful, just to synthesize it. So I hope that I can bring you today a few examples on how in our artistic praxis we interrogate questions around the relationship between humans and technology and the economic and sociopolitical models of this relationship. And I hope we can have some questions after and a bit of time to debate. So I'm going to start by introducing the project I created in 2015. It's the Institute of Human Obsolescence. It's an organization through which I explore with people from different fields, from economists, social scientists, technologists, activists, and other fields that we consider relevant to question how the changing relationship between humans and technology is shaping our societies. Particularly in our first projects that you see here in the image, we were questioning the future of work. So what is the repositioning that humans are subject to in a scenario in which forms of manual and intellectual labor are replaced by machines? So for this project, we were hiring human workers to perform worker shifts of 1, 2, or 3 hours. They were signing a contract that is there in the white surface, to wear a bodysuit that harvested their body heat to produce electricity. And with that electricity, we were powering a computer that is producing cryptocurrency. You might have heard of Bitcoin. So in order to produce cryptocurrency, you need computing power, you need electricity to power a computer. And this is what these humans were doing. We're just laying there without doing absolutely anything, but still producing a form of valuable capital for society. And the project has been presented in different places. Normally, we deploy the setup for 1 week. And people come and lays there, works. They receive the 80% of what is produced, and the institute receives the remaining 20%. So this was as a way to ask questions about this changing relationship between humans and machines. This is one of the screens that appears in the project. And with traditional jobs, normally we tend to know how much we are earning from the beginning of the working shift until the end. But when you are producing cryptocurrencies, you are dependent on the flows of value in the market. So here in the screen, we see in the beginning, the beginning of the working shift. And maybe after 3 hours, the value of your work has changed. So it might be that you are earning much more or you are earning much less, but this builds a dynamic of dependency on speculative markets. So if we are to think about this as a new form of work for the future, we will be incredibly dependent and subject to these flows of speculation in the market. So this was our first peek into what the future might be like. But then we started to think more and more, what are the current forms of new forms of labor that we are already working. And I find particularly as a good example, but there are many others, what happens now with platforms like Uber. So in Spain, in Germany, and I'm sure in France too, there has been a lot of mobilizations of taxi drivers protesting against Uber. And this is, in a way, something concrete, like we can protest against Uber, against their prices, and so on. But the most difficult question comes, what will happen when we will have self-driving cars? Will we be able to crystallize a form of political agency to protest and build demands against what? Against the machines? Like, are we thinking in bringing a new Luddite movement that will go and destroy the machines? I think it's particularly interesting to think also how the focus of these protests many times is about boycotting Uber drivers, but the Uber drivers themselves are subject to very precarious forms of work, and at the end of the day, one of their hidden forms of work is the production of data. So at the end of the day, Uber drivers, and Uber is losing just this year, and we haven't finished the year yet, $5 billion of dollars, but they sustain their business model in the collection of data, in how we are driving, from where we want to move, and so on. And the day of tomorrow, both taxi drivers and Uber drivers will be replaced by the self-driving car. This is an experiment that Uber launched a few years ago in San Francisco, in which there is already a fleet of self-driving cars running through the streets. So in a way, we could say that the Uber drivers are becoming the architects of their own obsolescence. Now I'm going to talk about three installations. It's a series called Data Production Labor Series, in which we ask a very simple question. What if we will understand our relationship with technological platforms, not from the perspective of being users of a so-called free service, but if we will approach this relationship from the perspective of we are the workers that we are producing data for these companies? In the screen, you can see a patent that was registered by Facebook a few years ago, in which they are developing a form of automatic facial recognition. So nowadays, when you make a Facebook post, you can say, I am feeling happy, I am feeling nervous, I am feeling scared. This patent says, no, we can just look at the camera component and predict your behavior. So when thinking about surveillance capitalism, we use the framework of Susanna Zuboff, in which she refers to the idea of economies of prediction. There are new economies being built based on the idea that we can predict future behavior. And to problematize that, we create the first installation, Data Production Labor, in which we ask the participants to perform what we call a working shift of 2 minutes, in which they just have to scroll down in their Facebook timeline. They don't have to like, to post, or to create any kind of content. We are not speaking here about click workers, but we are speaking about behavioral extraction. So in the way that I scroll, depending on the post or the speed that I stop and look at, and especially if Facebook can understand my reaction, when I scroll down and I see a post of Donald Trump and my face becomes angry, they can extract that data in order to build economies of prediction. After the working shift, the installation provides you a receipt that is an invitation to demand a form of payment from Facebook. So thinking, we have been thinking a lot of economical proposals of if our data has value, how do we want to relate? And there has been a lot of different proposals from approaching data as a commodity that builds a lot of problematics. We work with the one of data as a form of labor. This is the second installation. I'm sure you are all familiar with the CAPTCHA systems. It's a so-called free service, again, in which you have to fill a small task in order to prove that you are not a robot. But what is actually happening is that we are performing invisible labor, and every time I say in one image, this is a car, this is a car in this case, or a zebra crossing or a traffic light, we are training image recognition systems. Through the revelations that whistleblowers working within Google revealed around a bit more than a year ago, I believe, we learned that Google sold this technology secretly to the US Department of Defense to be used in their drone program. So imagine that every time you are filling one of these captchas, you are being participant, you are being complicit in the development of military infrastructure that is involved in drone strikes in many countries in which the US is at war. Of course, this is not presented to us as such. Like, we are not knowing that our labor is being used for this, nor they are asking us for consent. So in this second installation, you are invited to fill a series of captchas, and at the end you receive a receipt that in this case does not refer to a form of economic retribution, but refers to your own involvement and complicity in military activities. So we can say that the economic logic of surveillance capitalism exploits our invisible labor for the non-consensual development of military infrastructure. And in the third installation of this series, this is a patent of Amazon. You don't have to read it, I will just summarize it for you. There is a woman who is asking something to Alexa, one of these voice assistants, but this woman is coughing while speaking. Alexa is able to detect that, and in addition to reply with an answer to the question, is also suggesting, do you want me to order coughing pills with 2 hours delivery by Amazon? So this can seem as a banal example because it's just coughing pills, but if we see the exponential evolution of these platforms, this is a form of replacement of public healthcare. This woman might not go to visit a doctor and will just rely in a private company to delegate our healthcare system. So this is the installation that we built to interrogate these promised ideas. It's a voice assistant, an Amazon Echo, that is hacked, so it has a different dialogue. Unfortunately, there is no time to play it. But when you ask a specific sentence, Alexa, am I working for you? A special dialogue gets triggered in which Alexa herself speaks about surveillance capitalism, speaks about data extractivism, and deconstructs how, through the data that we are providing to her, they are building new forms of infrastructure. So with these three installations, we wanted to emphasize that big tech is not just building digital monopolies, but those monopolies are largely expanding beyond the digital, are going to replace our forms of public transportation, of public healthcare. In the case of Microsoft, they have been developing new educational programs that are delivered to poor countries such as Ecuador, with the promise of, with this artificially intelligent educational system, your economy will grow, you don't have money for your educational broken system, so we can provide that. These practices also carry a lot of what Renata Avila names as digital colonialism, and those are new forms of extraction of resources, in this case, how big tech from the United States goes to places in Latin America, and extracts the data of the users to then deliver again services, private services, to those countries. So all of this series of installations were very much about critiquing, revealing, and opening the black boxes of how surveillance capitalism works. But we also have been working in a series of proposals. So we are also using the space of art to propose different economical and sociopolitical systems. We have been exploring ideas such as the data basic income. So we started with the question of, if our data has value and there are many voices asking for receiving payments for those, are we going to receive different payments for that? Is my data more valuable than Xenia's data? Are then we going to replicate models of inequality and to systematize them? So we were exploring this idea of data basic income as a form of interrogation, because very soon we also realized a lot of problematics with that proposal. As if, for example, maybe I am in the need of this, let's say it's $1,000 per month that I receive in exchange for my data, and I work in a precarious situation, so I will protect that business model. And maybe some of you are against giving your data away, but receiving a payment for our data could turn around and be a way to legitimize this extreme extraction of data. Some of the other proposals we explore are the data cooperative that we have also been working with Xenia, and the most perhaps interesting one is the idea of a data workers union. So starting from this idea, if we will change how we see ourselves from users to workers, suddenly I'm not an isolated user, but I am part of a new collectivity of we all in this room as data workers. And we are exploring the idea of a data workers union as a means to establish a form of collective agency. I don't think that we can continue fighting these massive forms of extractivism by just encrypting our messages, because maybe a very few of us have the time, the skills, and the knowledge in how to do so. But we believe that the reply should be a collective reply. This is one image of one of the assemblies we organized in The Hague with economist René Magie on my left and Señor Mosina on my right. And we have been organizing a series of assemblies and events in different countries. So this is a short explanation of what we have been doing from the Institute. And now I want to explain you a little bit of the latest project that was released 2 months ago. This is a project I worked together with my colleague from Bangalore in India, Nayantara Ranganathan. It's at .watch, not .com, but .watch. It's about how we live in a new ecosystem of political propaganda. So I always like to explain this as, in the past, or a few years ago, we will gather in the public square and look at a political advertisement. Regardless of if we agree or not with this advertisement, with this political message, we can all see the same message. So that creates a space in this public square in which we can activate our political participation. Regardless of if this is fake news or we agree or not, we are all part of the same reality. One of the things that targeted advertisement enables is that through our production of personal data, companies such as Facebook, but Google, Twitter, and many others are operating in the same way, can target individually to each of us the political message that we are more likely to agree with. So that means that this public square of political participation gets broken and leaves us with a broken ground for exercising democracy. So in the project, we collected all the political advertisements of the major political parties in 34 countries. This is over 300 political parties now. Unfortunately, we just have all the European countries, India, Israel, Ukraine, Canada, and the United States. Facebook has refused to make available through their API the data in other countries. So again, interesting to think how Facebook goes to Argentina, extracts data from the users, but then they do not provide the levels of transparency that we benefit here in the West. These are some of the interfaces. This is, for example, the interface of the United States, in which the bigger the size is the most amount of advertisements. So in this case, the advertisement that received the most funding in the United States is an advertisement of Donald Trump as a petition to build the wall. So through AdWatch, let's say normally we are always discussing of how much will the wall cost. Through AdWatch, we can understand how much money is Trump investing in speaking about the wall in sponsored propagandas. We can also analyze by region. So this is a heat map in which areas one party or the other is putting more attention in speaking about which issue. And we can also understand demographic targeting. And I think this is at the core of some of the problems that targeted advertisement creates, in which I can say, I want to target an advertisement with this particular message in the region of Paris to a woman between 18 to 25 years old. So this level of precision allows me to maybe, let's say, half of the room here is against immigration, half of the room here is in favor of immigration. A political party can now create 2 messages and individually target each of you with the message that you are more likely to agree with. I'm exaggerating and simplifying the example, but you get an idea of the problematics that targeted advertisement provokes for our democracies. This is an artistic rendition of what we call the automated ads. Xenia was referring to before that looks like a mandala, never heard before.
Like a petri dish.
Like a petri dish of propaganda, maybe. So each circle represents 1 second in time, and each color represents one political party. So here we have all the political parties in the database. So for example, you see one very big pink circle there. It's from Kamala Harris, one of the presidential candidates for the United States. And there has been, in that very second, over 6,000 advertisements created at the same time. So by creating this visualization, we can emphasize the automated nature of how these propagandas function. We have a bunch of visualizations more in the website, so I invite you all to explore it. We have France, of course, so you can understand also what goes on here. And I'm just exactly nearing my 20 minutes now, so I will be very happy to take some questions, if there are some, and thank you.
Do we have any question from the audience? Thanks for turning the mic on.
And I have a question regarding the last part that you presented on digital advertising and targeted advertising. Like last time I went to a conference, I was talking about this topic. Somebody talked about the possibility for political parties to target two separate groups with contradicting messages according to their own preferences. But they said that they were pretty sure that it could be done, it was probably done, but they hadn't found any evidence yet. And I was wondering whether in the course of your project you had stumbled upon such evidence, because that would be very interesting to have.
Right, so for the last 2 months has been of a new form of artistic practice for me, but we are most of the time working with journalists. So, for example, in Sky News in the UK, we released 2 weeks ago a story on how political parties were targeting minors with political messages. I think in the interface of the United States, a lot of US media picked it up to map these different political messages. So there has been many cases that we have found. We started the project in India because we were there during the Indian elections, and we found 2,235 advertisements that were in violation of electoral law, that were basically breaking the silence day. I don't know if in France you have such a thing as the silence day before the elections. Yeah, so you cannot make political advertisements and so on. But those regulations were not applied when it came to the domain of politically sponsored propagandas. And we faced also an interesting question that was, we had the possibility of reporting those advertisements to the Electoral Commission, so the public institution that is supposed to keep in check our democracies, or to Facebook. We reported it to the Electoral Commission, not to Facebook, because we thought that was the right thing to do. They did not take action. We wondered if they even understood the report that we filed for them. And we found really problematic the idea of reporting this to Facebook, because that will mean that we are outsourcing our democratic infrastructures to a private company, to a foreign private company. So again, as we were discussing before about public infrastructures such as transportation being replaced, we perhaps will be thinking also how democratic infrastructure is being co-opted by these platforms, in that they are becoming the main source for news, but also the main source for political debate and for political advertisement.
Thank you. Do we have more questions?
Thank you. I'm wondering two things. You are raising two questions. One is about what makes humans human, and we have been raised for centuries or even more to think that humans have value because they work. And maybe we should question this assessment. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is redistribution of value. Because if we replace humans creating value with machines creating value, it means that who is going to have this value? So should we all become shareholders?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think we have some colleagues on the room that have been investigating that quite deeply. I'm referring to you. Let me put it that way. I think perhaps we were focusing very much in the problematics, but if let's think also in the opportunities. So if we have now the opportunity of build a new fantastic blockchain-driven AI healthcare system, why to have it on the hands of a private company? Could we draw inspiration from the free software movement? I mean, I'm simplifying here again, but if we will approach this AI healthcare system as the Linux kernel, as something that we could all choose to contribute to, that no private actor could own, and that we can all benefit from. So those are some of the proposals that we have exploring also from the Data Workers Union. How can we build new forms of collective ownership of the new...
Thank you very much for the very interesting presentation. This is a curiosity question, since we're talking across occupations here. I'll be curious to know your perspective. You're basically telling us about Facebook and, you know, decontextualizing the use of data that Facebook does to generate revenue. What's your own economic model for sustaining your own artistic activities? Do you use the data that people, you know, that you can gather through those different projects? How do you use them? And in general, you know, how do you see yourself in this ecosystem and your own sustainability as an artist?
Well, the straightforward question about the installations collect no data. So we do not harvest or store any of the data of the participants. Basically, when you interact with one of the installations, there is no variable in the code that stores anything. Okay. As an artist, basically, I have built my artistic practice on my student credit. So I, as you might have guessed, I do not operate within the traditional artistic circles, nor from academic circles. So I'm a bit of a black sheep for both worlds, maybe. But I think beyond our use of data, I think our role with our projects is to rather interrogate the existing infrastructures that are there and their business models and propose ideas that we can create the space to interrogate. So we did not have very much political space to discuss initiatives such as the Data Workers Union. So we try to use the space of art to create ecosystems of relations that do not fit nowadays with the current status quo of politics or even of activism.
And of research, I guess, as well. And of research, if I may interrupt you, because I also had a question about how do you see your interaction with academic world? Do you see any perspectives for art to be involved fully in the production of knowledge? And because now often we speak of artists as users of, would it be an AI or a technology to produce a work of art? Whereas in your work, I see more holistic approach where the artist would come in the beginning, even before a research question has been formulated, to actually break the ice in the zone where there has not been yet a questioning or where the questioning was formulated in a, let's say, not radically enough. So maybe you can comment on your engagement with research.
Right, so I don't know how in this room we are familiar with the idea of artistic research. Also, I think very much is a term that is being misused within circle in the arts. I very much operate and create my works on the basis of researching and exploring questions that then eventually lead to these kinds of interventions to ask questions. I find myself quite excited of operating as an artist because I am having the space to ask questions that I don't know about you, but I hear many times by researchers that this does not fit in my research question. So I'm extremely happy of the invitation to be here today and also in the working group yesterday on art, AI, and creativity of trying to start to think how to engage with artistic research, not just at the end of the project, so we make some beautiful PowerPoint presentation at the end, but to try to ask from the very beginning the questions. So this is more a bit of a provocation for you to also think, and please come back to me with your thoughts. This is a thought in progress for me. But I think for the challenges that we are facing already nowadays and for the challenges that are upcoming when it comes to the development of internet and our societies. Perhaps we need art to think also beyond what the existing questions that we are facing now, but what the new questions that are going to come in the future might look like. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Manuel. We are a little bit ahead of time, so I'm have to close this session, but you can find Manuel during the coffee breaks. And thanks again for coming.